Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. As we head toward the November midterms, Democrats are hoping for gains in Congress. For Republicans, maintaining control of the House seems precarious, and for Democrats, regaining control of the Senate appears to hinge on some very key races. North Carolina is one of them. Democrat Roy Cooper has the edge over Republican Michael Whatley in our state, and if that lead holds, a Democratic victory here may help make the difference. Recent polls also indicate Democrats may have a chance at making inroads in North Carolina legislative contests, believe it or not. We're going to look at all of that and more with several politics watchers, but we begin with the unexpected death of South Carolina senior Senator Lindsey Graham on Saturday night, just days after his 71st birthday. Senator Graham was first elected in 2002 and was running for his fifth term. He also transformed himself from an anti-Trump candidate into one of Donald Trump's staunchest supporters. For that part of the conversation, we're joined by Dr. Scott Huffman, professor of political science and director of the Center for Public Opinion and Policy Research at Winthrop University. Also with us is Dr. Chris Cooper, director of the Public Policy Institute at Western Carolina University and author of Anatomy of a Purple State, a North Carolina Politics Primer. Kurt Beto is editor of a National Journal Hotline, which covers day-to-day political news from races nationwide. And Danielle Battaglia is back with us. She is congressional impact reporter for the Charlotte Observer and the Raleigh News and Observer. Thank you all for being here. Good morning. Scott, I'm going to begin with you. Lindsey Graham replaced Strom Thurmond from South Carolina in the Senate. Thurmond was a force to be reckoned with. How would you describe Senator Graham?
Well, you know, we're forgetting that he was part of the Newt Gingrich Republican Revolution in the House of Representatives. So he was elected in 1994 to a House seat that had not been Republican since Reconstruction after the Civil War. So he was really part of the reshaping of Southern politics and the shift from Democratic to Republican. Now, they were all conservative whites, but the conservative whites were switching from Democratic to Republican. He came in as a firebrand, voting super conservative, but he very quickly moderated his voting and became a deal maker. And that really defined a lot of his congressional time, especially in the Senate. And of course, he's also remembered in the House as one of the 13 prosecutors for Bill Clinton's impeachment.
Right. He was highly critical of Trump, the candidate, at a time when he, too, was running for president. He called Donald Trump a demagogue, a race-baiting, xenophobic, religious bigot. He told CNN in 2015, if you want to make America great again, tell Donald Trump to, quote, go to hell. But when Trump won the election, he became a supporter, a staunch supporter, perhaps one of his strongest supporters. Following January 6th, Graham said he was done with Trump. Enough's enough, he said. But then he reversed course yet again and continued to be one of his biggest supporters, and despite disagreeing with him on his policy on Ukraine. So what does that tell us about the man?
Lindsey Graham was one of the greatest political survivors out there. You know, he knew which way the political winds blew, and even when he first charted a quote-unquote wrong course, like calling Trump crazy, a kook, unfit for office, when he saw he needed to change, he hoisted his sails and got back into Trump's good graces in a way that very few people could have that quickly.
Which begs the question, does he have, and did he have any core beliefs? Did he have any principles?
Well, on big showy items, he was willing to go back and forth. You know, early on, he was very consistent on voting very moderate on immigration. He certainly changed that near the end. One of his core beliefs that he always stayed with, he was always a foreign policy hawk. When it came to American involvement abroad, even until his dying day, he was pushing, you know, America to be involved there, whether it was the Iraq War, the current Iran War, our involvement in Afghanistan. He pushed Trump to continue to support Ukraine. I don't believe we would still be supporting Ukraine even to the level we are had it not been for Lindsey Graham. And that has definitely been consistent across his entire time in Congress.
Kirk Beto is with us. He's the editor of the National Journal Hotline. Graham became one of the leading voices in the Senate over time. He was always on the national talk shows. He was, in fact, scheduled to be on Meet the Press this past Sunday, the day after he passed away. How did he become so influential? He's from South Carolina, not one of the bigger states. How did that happen, Kirk?
He had a great way of making himself available to reporters. We've been chasing around him on the Capitol for a little bit up here, and he's always good for a hallway chat. He's always very quotable. I think he's got a very nice personal touch with reporters as well. And to Scott's point here, he does a great job of being in the room, or at least getting to talk to people who are in the room where decisions are made. He's, again, part of that 94 Gingrich revolution. He's done an incredible job of ingratiating himself with Trump, and with him gone, Trump is losing one of his key allies in the Senate, someone who could really at least kind of tell it like it is to Trump. He's, yes, always directing his sail to wherever the political wind is blowing. But I think in his ability to get back in with Trump after not only what he said in 2016, but also January 6 as well, I really think that he's been a great job at talking to Trump in a way that gets him across the line. And he was also very influential on the Judiciary Committee as well, and shepherding Trump's nominees through one of his high water marks, at least in his legislative career, was the 2018 fight over Brett Kavanaugh's nomination to the Supreme Court, and Graham being kind of the righteous hammer against a bunch of the critics from Kavanaugh and Democrats especially.
Scott, you mentioned that he has this had this ability to work across the aisle, and although while he was in the House, he helped manage Bill Clinton's impeachment trial. He later became very good friends with then Senator Hillary Clinton, which seems odd. Yet he also embraced Donald Trump, whose vitriol against his political enemies arguably has changed the tenor of our political conversations in this country. Help me understand this. This seems odd to me.
Well, who you're friends with and who your opponents are politically can be very different things. The Hillary Clinton friendship, I think, had to do a lot more with personality than it did with his, broadsides against Bill Clinton. But we also know mainly his best friendship was with John McCain. But John McCain was also extremely close with Hillary Clinton, and I'm guessing that that was sort of the initial connection. There are lots of stories of them, trading vodka shots on planes across the world. So his ability to be friends with people that he would be virtually screaming at in committee hearings later on was kind of amazing.
Chris, you study this as well. Chris Cooper is with us from Western Carolina University. He just mentioned how close Senator Graham was to John McCain. He was kind of an acolyte of John McCain. And yet Donald Trump was just blisteringly negative toward John McCain, and he's a close ally, was a close ally of Donald Trump. Should we want more of this in our politics, this ability to go b to both sides and make friends on both sides, or should we want less of it? Do we want people who have the courage of their convictions and won't moderate?
I mean, to go with the dated meme, why not both, Mike? Like, I think there is a world in which we have people who can be friendly and can disagree without being disagreeable in private, and at the same time have convictions, right? I think having convictions and being able to work across the aisle should not be orthogonal ideas, right? These two things should be able to work together in American politics. And I think what everybody's pointing about Lindsey Graham, in some ways, he is kind of a politics is going away, right? So he comes in 94. He's one of these Gingrich senators. In other words, people who came in with Gingrich, then they go to the United States Senate and they transform the Senate, right? They make the Senate from you know, basically a much more partisan body, much more like the House was, much more leadership led, just like Newt Gingrich had done, right? So they sort of learned from that. The other thing about Lindsey Graham, I think that everybody's bringing up, in addition to his ability to walk across the aisle, he's a foreign policy expert. And so he comes from a time in American politics in which members of Congress, senators and House members were expected to have an area of expertise, heaven forbid, right? And so I think all of that carries through. It's all true at the same time, right? He gets along with folks, yet he goes at them. He is a specialist, but somebody who will talk to Kurt Beto about any subject under the sun at any given time, right? He was all of that at once. And I do think that a lot of that was good, even if you don't happen to like his particular brand of, you know, ideological politics.
Senator Graham has been given credit for helping navigate the Trump administration's strained relationships with Ukraine. Scott Huffman brought that up a little while ago, and Trump announced just, I think, over the weekend that the U.S. will now grant Ukraine a license to produce its own Patriot missile interceptors, which is a major shift in our policy. And we know that Trump changes his mind like many of us change our socks. But was Senator Graham any kind of moderating influence on that? And what, Kirk, do you see might be happening in the very near future with his absence?
But Professor Hoffman's point earlier that one of the reasons that we're still supporting Ukraine in the second Trump administration has to be credited to Lindsey Graham. And his loss is a massive loss for Ukraine in Congress. Between him suddenly dying this weekend and Mitch McConnell's prolonged absence, the real Ukraine hawks in that Republican conference aren't there in the Senate right now. It's going to make it a lot more difficult. I would imagine that people are going to start getting into Trump's ear more about potentially dialing back commitment to Ukraine here in the next few months here, depending on how long Mitch McConnell's out here. But it's a huge, huge loss for Ukraine. I believe there was an article in Time magazine this weekend after Senator Graham's death that said that he was the man for Ukraine. And I don't think we can really underestimate his foreign policy influence.
Scott, I lose you in about 2 minutes because you have other things to do this morning for some odd reason. But people outside the Palmetto State know Senator Graham because of all the things we've been talking about this morning. Talk to me quickly about what he did for his South Carolina constituents.
Well, you know, we knew his sort of difficult life backstory. And he also came into the South Carolina legislature and worked hard for ethics reform in the state legislature. There were huge scandals that, and then he was involved in sort of bringing that ethics reform. He also was of the Senator Byrd mindset, although not quite as large. He did bring bacon home to South Carolina. He, you know, helped South Carolina in ways that rhetorically a lot of senators don't even care about anymore. So he really was sort of a senator in South Carolina that did things that weren't noticed nationally, that brought money back. Even so, a lot of the Republicans would be constantly angry with him. His approval ratings were always below Tim Scott's, but he worked hard to bring stuff home for South Carolina.
I have about 30 seconds left. His death leaves a vacuum in the Senate. It also leaves a vacuum in leadership in South Carolina, in their Senate delegation. Tim Scott now becomes the senior senator. Can he fill those shoes?
It'll be tough. We lose a lot of seniority. The Republican Party loses some key seats on key committees, especially the Judiciary Committee. But Tim Scott has always been incredibly popular among Republicans. He will step in and step up.
Dr. Scott Huffman is the director of the Center for Public Opinion and Policy Research at Winthrop University. Thank you for being with us. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about Senator Graham and then move on to other political issues in a moment.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and United Way of Greater Charlotte, celebrating 95 years of impact in the Carolinas, strengthening nonprofits, neighborhoods, and people through the support of charitable contributions. More at UnitedWayGreaterCLT.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Dr. Chris Cooper, professor of political science and director of the Public Policy Institute at Western Carolina University. Kirk Beto is editor of the National Journal Hotline, and Danielle Battaglia is congressional impact reporter with the Charlotte Observer and the Raleigh News and Observer. Just as Democrats in Maine are now scrambling to replace Graham Plattner in Maine, who dropped out of the Senate race there against Susan Collins, South Carolina Republicans will now have to find a replacement for Lindsey Graham for an election just 4 months away, Danielle. South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster can appoint somebody to fill out that term. Must he? Will he? Of course he will.
I mean, who doesn't want to make that appointment, right? So there's not a timeline. If I'm saying this right, I don't believe there's a timeline on when he has to do that. There is a timeline on when they're going to have to hold a special primary to replace the Republican nominee, which was Graham. Sorry, don't know why I blanked on his name. And so there are several people who are being considered for that or considering putting themselves in for that. One of the biggest names we're hearing is Representative Nancy Mace. I think she tweeted this morning, "They keep pulling me back in."
Who is that?
That is a great question, and people that did not land well on social media. So she's one name that is being floated. We're also seeing Representative Joe Wilson, Representative Ralph Norman, and Lieutenant Governor Pamela Everett are all the names that I am hearing at this point. I think there's a couple other people that have also been floated.
And of course, that person could choose to run for the seat in November. And that is, how will they decide that situation, Chris? How will they decide who that candidate to run against Democrat Annie Andrews will be?
Well, because they haven't had enough primary elections in the state of South Carolina, they thought they'd have another. So essentially, we get two separate processes. One, Danielle described perfectly, of course, where we get this appointment from Henry McMaster, but then anybody who wants to, including the aforementioned Nancy Mace and many others, can stick their hat in the ring for an election. That'll be, I think it's August 4th, when we're actually going to have that special election in South Carolina. Additional wrinkle, right, because we're in the South, we could have a runoff here. So if the leading candidate does not get 50% plus one vote, we head to a runoff. My expectation is we're going to get a whole lot of people. We're going to get all comers, essentially, into the special election. Maybe the odds of a runoff here may actually be fairly high. So if you are a Republican in South Carolina, it is not impossible. One might even argue likely. You could actually vote in four primaries before we even get to the general election this year.
Of course, Nancy Mace and Ralph Norman both ran to be on the Republican in the Republican primary to be the governor of South Carolina to replace Henry McMaster, who is term limited. And they didn't do well in that primary. Does that hurt their chances in any general or primary election for the United States Senate? And which of the candidates that Danielle mentioned, and anybody can answer this question, would have the better chance of defeating Annie Andrews? Or does she have any shot at all, even if they nominate a pumpkin to be the senator, because it's a red state?
If that pumpkin has an R next to its name, I think it will be okay. I think the question that, you know, Danielle articulated very well is that, is this appointment going to be a caretaker, or is it going to be someone who's interested in running for in the special election? I think Pam Avett is probably the lieutenant governor who finished second in that primary. If she gets appointed to the position, I would bet that she goes in on to run in the special election. In terms of other caretakers, it could be even someone like Lindsey Graham's sister, Darlene Graham Norden, who's getting floated around for this as well. So we'll just have to wait and see here. But I think whoever emerges from that August special election primary is going to be in the driver's seat come November.
Danielle, Senator Graham had Donald Trump's ear as much as anybody can have it. He was a powerful presence in the national media, but most of the work, I'm sure, as you as a reporter know, is done behind the scenes on Capitol Hill. What does his absence do to the balance of power in the Senate?
I think there's a couple different things. He obviously was a force in the Senate, and his loss to South Carolina, this is a man who's been around since the mid-90s in Congress, and so that's going to be felt across South Carolina. As for the balance of power, we're already looking at a very tight margin in the Senate, and so to lose, right now we're looking at two people that were losing this week with both Graham and Mitch McConnell, the Senate leader, being in the hospital. And so that majority vote is so narrow right now. And until we get a replacement in there, that vote is going to be tight. Looking ahead to the election, you know, Republicans want to maintain power. I think South Carolina is so red. Trump has won that a state three times in a row by double digits. I don't think we're going to be hurting to find a Republican to replace Graham, but that power that he wielded in the Senate is going to definitely have a different tone without him.
So Lindsey Graham will likely be replaced by another Republican. So that seat will stay on the GOP side. But Kirk, despite Graham Plattner withdrawing from the race in Maine, where it appeared that he had a shot to unseat longtime Republican Senator Susan Collins, I guess you wrote that the Democrats are inching closer to potentially flipping Senate control, but they remain the underdogs. How so?
Right. It's just a math problem for them here. They have to net four seats in order to flip the Senate. They have to hit three seats in the House, and it's a lot easier in the House. The House is much more attuned to the winds of the national political environment, but the Senate, it's a matter of environment versus terrain here. And the terrain for the Senate map this year is difficult. There's not really a whole lot of gimmies for Democrats like there were for Republicans 2 years ago, where Democrats in West Virginia, Ohio, and Montana were on the ballot. Deep red states that have never voted for Democrat presidential candidate in recent election cycles. The closest thing they had to a gimme is maybe Maine. Susan Collins, the Republican there, is the only Republican who represents a state that Trump never carried. But this disaster of a Plattner campaign raised a lot of questions here. And now that we're in July, we still don't have a nominee on the Democratic side. They're going to have to microwave a campaign really quick. Outside of that, the battlefield gets a lot tougher. The next easiest pickup opportunity is maybe North Carolina, where former Democratic Governor Roy Cooper is running, and I think he's probably in the lead there. But then you still need two more seats while defending all your seats as well as a Democrat. And the battlefield after that kind of trails off. You're looking at places like Ohio.
One place that it seems to be a little optimistic, Danielle, is here in North Carolina. Roy Cooper, the former Democratic governor, seems to be doing very well against his opponent so far. Cooper enjoys double-digit leads in several polls over RNC or former RNC chair Michael Whatley. In fact, I don't know of a poll in which he does not lead. What are you hearing from members of both parties about this race?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think Professor Cooper, who's on the call with us, put this best to me of, Whatley, there's the possibility that Whatley could still win, but if Roy Cooper loses, there's no blue wave this year. Democrats are going to lose across the board because we are seeing double digit wins in polls by Governor Cooper. He's been running, I think, probably a year to the day now. And Whatley was a week behind him. And I have not seen a single poll where Whatley has won. Now, I have heard from the campaigns, there are not attack ads yet. I mean, they have attacked each other in the press, but we have not seen those attack ads that are in people's faces. I've actually seen the first Michael Whatley ad on YouTube this week. And I think that could make the difference. Well, I shouldn't say make the difference. I think it could make a difference in what we're seeing with the polls as we get closer to the election and maybe tightening that margin. But I don't think that Michael Whatley has done enough to get his name ID out in North Carolina. People are still wondering who he is.
Roy Cooper has never lost an election, Dr. Cooper. And recently, Danielle wrote in a column that North Carolinians have not elected a Democrat to the Senate since 2008, when Kay Hagan defeated incumbent Senator Elizabeth Dole. So what would a Democrat victory, Chris, at this time tell you about the current political climate in North Carolina?
Well, I promise I'll get to your current thing, but just a little bit on the past, because I have to do that sort of thing. It comes with a PhD. So, yes, it is true, of course, that North Carolina has not elected a Democratic senator since 2008. That's a fact. That's real. But at the same time, Senate elections, like Kurt mentioned before, don't come up in 2-year cycles, right? They come up in kind of weird cycles, 6-year cycles. And if you look at when North Carolina's had Senate seats come up, they're like really bad years for Democrats. So the wind has been, in other words, behind the Republicans' back in almost every election since 2008. And this is the first time in a very long time where the wind is unquestionably behind the Democrats' back instead of in their face. And so I think that explains a lot of this weird outcome where you say, well, they haven't done anything since 2008. Why should this year be different? It's because this is a different year. So what does it mean for kind of Republicans in North Carolina in general? It means this is a good year for Democrats. North Carolina is a state that tends to follow the national tide more than most. And I've sort of done a lot of analysis to try to quantify this, but the bottom line is it's true, right? Like, we tend to follow the national tide. The national tide's good for Dems. It's going to be good for Roy Cooper.
And most of the polls indicate that we're moving from toss-up to leans Democrat. But we still have 4 months to go till November's election. Can we trust the polls, Chris, at this stage of the game?
I think we can trust the polls to tell us what we always can, which is right now, if the election were held today, this is the deal. But the election is not held today. Right? It is held in November. The key problem for Michael Wadley, and everybody's saying this for a reason, because it's true, is that nobody knows who he is, right? Republican insiders know who Michael Wadley is very well. He's not a bad candidate. He's not making, there's no scandal. There's no Mark Robinson thing here. He's able to raise some money. But at the same time, the average person at the Walmart in Murphy, North Carolina, doesn't know his name. And that's what you're going to need to win a Senate election in 2026 in North Carolina.
Sure. And look, to Dr. Cooper's point here, this is not going to be a 15-point race here. If you think on November when the ballots are finally counted that Roy Cooper's going to win by 15 points, then I have some beachfront property to sell you at Western Carolina University. That's not going to be the case here. Michael Wadley is not a Mike Robinson-esque candidate. There's no deep history of scandal here. It's going to get tight, but in order for this race to get a little bit closer, Republicans are going to have to start really investing money attacking Roy Cooper here. And we've already seen tons of millions of dollars of outside money committed to North Carolina already. This could be the most expensive Senate race in the country this year.
So as Dr. Cooper just pointed out, Kirk, the wind seems to be at the back of Democrats for many reasons in this election cycle, and North Carolina tends to go perhaps with the wind. How many other states that are in play tend to go with the wind?
Well, I would say especially in a midterm year, somewhere like Michigan especially. Now, Michigan is going to probably be key in deciding not just the Senate, there's an open Senate race there, but a handful of House races as well. In a midterm election cycle, the electorate's a lot different, especially in the Trump era, than with the president on the ballot. It's going to be a really competitive Senate race. There's about 3 House races we're eyeing up there at Hotline as well. I would keep an eye on Michigan and North Carolina. And one more, Iowa. If I had a crystal ball right now and could know the results of only one state come November to figure out how the midterms went, it would be Iowa. There's an open governor's race, open Senate race. 3 of the 4 congressional races are going to be really competitive as well. In fact, we could have the entire congressional delegation in Iowa change over between 2026 and 2027 with only Chuck Grassley staying around. And he'll probably be a senator and be in Congress long after all of us are gone.
I don't think we'll ever know what would have happened in the Graham Plattner race against Susan Collins, but it appeared to be that Democrats at least were very excited about his candidacy, and now they kind of want Chuck Schumer and his brand of Democrats to stay out of that race in Maine and perhaps go in the direction of social Democrats that seem to be winning elections around the country. In the absence of Graham Plattner, is there anybody who can take his place that has a shot at unseating Susan Collins in Maine, Kirk?
I think the best thing the Democrats could have there is someone, a generic Democrat. You want someone with the blanket slate possible. You know, it's not the same as in South Carolina, where the pumpkin with an R next to its name is probably going to win that election in November. There are a few more progressive-leaning candidates who are going to run in this nomination convention. In the next few weeks here, Troy Jackson is a state lawmaker. There is probably the clearest in the mold of at least the politics of Graham Plattner, but he's going to have a lot of issues because he foolhardily embraced Plattner on the campaign trail. There's tons of video and content of them together. If I was Troy Jackson, I'd be trying to get as much daylight between myself and Graham Plattner, the person, but not Graham Plattner's policies as possible.
Chris, somebody on this panel mentioned a moment ago that our Senate race here is likely to be the most expensive in the country. But the media landscape has changed a lot in the last several years. And I'm wondering if money matters as much anymore and where you put that money, because television and radio seem to be being eclipsed by social media, where it's harder, it's fragmented. Does money matter when we have such a divided country? I'm going to vote Republican or I'm going to vote Democrat. I don't care how many commercials you run.
Yes, money matters. That is different than saying that the person with the most money always wins the election, right? That's not true. But it is absolutely still true that money matters. I mean, one thing, it's an idea about support and who's behind you. These people who are giving big money to campaigns are smart investors, right? These people are not knuckleheads. They are not giving money to the pumpkin and, you know, the pumpkin Democrat in South Carolina, right? They're going to put their money where it matters. And so, one, it's got some predictive value. Two, yes, we're changing the media landscape, but the new media landscape isn't free, right? The production value, just because you move it to your iPhone, doesn't mean that there is nobody that's getting paid to be able to produce that work. So yes, it matters. I mean, I think Kirk's point's a really good one about North Carolina, obviously, and being expensive. I do wonder if some of that math is changing, right? So early in this year, we would say this is going to be $1 billion with a B race. Lots of folks, heck, I might have said it on this program at one point. Paul Shoemaker, very popular, very important Republican consultant, said it. Morgan Jackson, a Democratic consultant, said it. I think the environment may be changing some, though, right? So the Republicans have committed, that is their word, a lot of money in the tens of millions of dollars to North Carolina. That doesn't mean that money showed up. And I also think, since people said that $1 billion figure, Texas looks like maybe kind of interesting. Iowa looks interesting, as was pointed out. Michigan, all these other states. So the money may not come to North Carolina to the extent that we thought it would 6 months ago.
So, Danielle, I have a minute left. No matter who wins in the Senate race in North Carolina, Ted Budd will become the senior senator from the state, and we'll have a junior senator with very little experience as a candidate and an office holder in Michael Whatley, and a pretty popular guy in Roy Cooper. What will that mean for the citizens of North Carolina to have that mix in the Senate?
Well, depending on which mix, it could mean a lot of different things. With Ted Budd's a quieter, more get stuff done behind the scenes, doesn't talk to the media as much guy than we see with Tom Tillis. Michael Whatley isn't, you know, somebody who's done legislating before, where Roy Cooper's done a ton. And so we could see a different mix depending on which one wins.
So when we come back, we'll talk about shifting voter sentiment. We're going to talk about what's going on with House races around the country to a certain degree, and what voters want. Do we know what they want? Do the candidates know? Do they care? We'll find out in a moment in Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about politics today with Dr. Chris Cooper, professor of political science and director of the Public Policy Institute at Western Carolina University. Danielle Battaglia is with us. She is a congressional impact reporter for the Raleigh News and Observer and the Charlotte Observer. And Kirk Beto is with us, editor of National Journal Hotline. Danielle, if this state is shifting from toss-up to lean Democrat, as many polls would indicate, in the Senate race, what does that portend, if anything, for down-ballot races, for the U.S. House, for the General Assembly? Is there shifting political sentiment in North Carolina among voters?
I mean, that's a good question, but North Carolina, our voters are so different in that, like, we elect Republican presidents and Democratic senators. That's not what I'm trying to say. Governors is what I'm trying to say. And so, like, I don't know that, you know, as Chris was saying earlier, the winds kind of shift and we're shifting with them. I'm not sure that we can make that prediction, but I feel like Chris probably has a better answer than what I just gave.
Well, Chris, I mean, you can give that answer or you can answer this question. Answerer's choice. If sentiment is shifting, why is it shifting? Can we point to the economy? Can we point to dissatisfaction with Donald Trump? Can we point to people tiring of what appears to be Republican shenanigans to maintain power and control at the state and national level? What can we pin it on?
Yeah, I'm going to go for both. All right, let's see how this works out for me. I think to your answer to your question, Mike, I think it's the first two, right? I think it is dissatisfaction with Donald Trump, and it's a state of the economy and a little bit about what's happening in Iran. Sort of, you could, that's essentially what's happening. To Danielle's point before, look, there's most of our districts just aren't that competitive. So what could really be at play here? We're talking about the 11th congressional district and the first. That's essentially bookends of the state. Those are the two that maybe possibly, if you squint hard, might be able to go Democratic and actually flip those seats. In terms of the General Assembly, the Senate seats can survive electoral Chernobyl, right? They're Democrats are not going to get majority control of the state Senate. I'm talking about here in the state of North Carolina, just the way the districts are drawn. Folks can argue about whether that's residential sorting patterns or gerrymandering. Doesn't really matter for our conversation. It ain't moving much at all. The House is a little bit of a different story. My guess is the Democrats are going to pick up a few seats in the House. I think the supermajority, or even the quote working supermajority, is likely to be gone. Actually getting the majority in the House would be probably just outside of what the Democrats can do, but they are definitely trying to gain some seats there, and I doubt they're going to lose many, if any.
So when these polls, which I referred to at the very beginning of the program, come out and they say that the winds are shifting for Democrats and that gives them a better shot at the General Assembly, we're really talking about the House and not the Senate. And that's primarily because of how the districts have been drawn by Republicans to favor Republican candidates. It's almost impossible for Democrats to win in many of these districts. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And let's add to that too, just to overcomplicate a very complicated thing. We have this Stevenson clustering rule in North Carolina, which is super complicated, but basically what it means is certain counties have to hang together before you even draw the map. So some of this is baked into just the base map, the nature of these districts before the people in power even get in there and start monkeying with those districts. And then you put on top of that what is now explicit gerrymandering, because the folks in power figured out as long as they don't say race, they can absolutely get away with gerrymandering for their own partisan political gain. So you put that together, just not a lot of competitiveness left.
And
It
North Carolina,
amazes. Go ahead, Kurt. Go ahead.
I was going to say, the way I describe North Carolina to people up in DC here is that it always is on the knife's edge of redistricting maneuvers here. I don't think it's had the same U.S. House districts since the Obama administration, I believe. If there's ever sort of any sort of wave like what we're experiencing here, it's kind of like an etch-a-sketch where the folks at the General Assembly will just shake it clean and redraw it here. And to Dr. Cooper's point, those two races that we are watching are North Carolina 1, North Carolina 11. North Carolina 1 is the only swing-ish district. It's represented by a Democrat, Don Davis. But even then, that just got redrawn to won't favor Republicans. It's now a district that Trump would have carried by 11 points in 2024. It's going to be really tough. Same thing in North Carolina 11 with Republican Representative Chuck Edwards. He's got a pretty legitimate challenger there, but it's still going to be an uphill battle. And I think North Carolina is going to be a real test of if there is a blue wave cresting in November. If we want to find out where the peak of that blue wave is, check out North Carolina, at least on the House side.
It is said, Daniel, that most voters don't pay much attention to any of this politics at all until November, or until after Labor Day, because that's when the election cycle and the commercials begin in earnest, etc. But from what you know about what we're hearing up from voters about shifting sentiment and rising prices and gasoline prices and dissatisfaction with the war in Iran, etc. What are politics behind the scenes saying? How concerned are Republicans in the House and Senate about all of this? How hopeful are Democrats that you talk to?
I think Republicans are more concerned than they're letting on. They've got a big uphill battle with the economy right now. Trump had both. Actually, I'm going to hit two points here. Trump had campaigned both on fixing the economy and no new wars. We're in a new war. He's now calling it a war, so he's being upfront about it. And we also, I mean, the economy's rough. I was talking to my parents this weekend. I can't go to the store without spending $100. When I first graduated college, I was spending $33 each time I went to the store. I have not changed my lifestyle whatsoever. I'm still single. There is no difference. I have no children. That is a big difference to my wallet. And I know that Americans are feeling that when they check out. Gas prices are rising because of that new war in Iran that is impacting everyday Americans. And we haven't gotten a clear, good answer on why we are at war. And so I think both of those issues, you know, when you start touching Americans' lives, even though they don't pay attention until they get to that ballot box, they know something's going on that's affecting them and it's not being fixed in Washington. That bodes well for Democrats right now who can use that in their campaign cycles.
Perhaps we were spoiled, Chris, because for a long time, things like staples, food, et cetera, was not expensive. They just weren't expensive. Now they're blisteringly expensive. As Daniel mentioned, you go to the grocery store, you cannot get out of the grocery store. You would take a little plastic bag home and it's $45. There's nothing in it. It's ridiculous that what used to cost $35 at a restaurant is now $70. It's really hard. Gasoline prices are up. And yet we had this Marie Antoinette moment a little while ago with the president calling affordability a hoax. And he didn't care about what the ordinary people were going through when it comes to the Iran war. Why hasn't that infuriated voters, or has it?
I think it has, but the problem for the Democrats is people being infuriated and people blaming one of the two parties and overriding some of their other concerns. Like, that's a lot for folks to take into account. People don't just get, yes, the economy is the most important thing. Yes, it is. As Bill Clinton said, the economy's stupid. But at the same time, there's other things at play when people go to vote. And there's sort of long-term partisan dispositions that people hold, and they are entered into this messy economic situation. So it's one thing for the economy to be bad, and that is going to be to the benefit of the Democrats. But at the same time, then blaming the other party and at the same time making that change your vote is just a lot for people to ask who, I think, as you said before, may not be paying that much attention, right? The World Cup's been pretty interesting. We still got a baseball season going on, right? There's a lot. I'm watching the Tour de France, me and 9 other people. So there's a lot going on to pay attention to. And it just isn't the case that politics is the number one thing in most people's minds.
And yet, Donald Trump's approval ratings, somebody's paying attention, they have an opinion, are down to 39% to 41%. I think it depends on which poll you're looking at. But we keep hearing that his approval ratings are very low, despite what his Truth Social post said the other night. A real clear politics analysis shows, however, that Obama and Bush were about at the same level of approval at this point in their terms of office. So how do you describe the correlation to presidential approval ratings, Kirk, and how parties fare in the midterm elections? Are Republicans going to be dinged if his ratings don't go up?
You mentioned the historical perspective here, and that's exactly right, especially on the House side of presidential approval rating is kind of the most direct correlation we have to how that party in power is going to perform in the midterms. Now, historically, on average, in the first midterm cycle of a president, his party loses 26 seats. That's been the average between 1930 and 2018. You mentioned Trump's approval ratings right now, somewhere between probably at 37-41%, depending on the pollster. That's right between jury duty and a journalist, and you don't want to be there right now as a president. You look at some of the historical perspective here. In 2006, Bush was the, or 2002 was the one of the only times in history in the last 100 or so years that the party in power gained seats in the House. And that was mostly due to the aftermath after 9/11 here. Every other time the party in power loses, look in 2006, Rahm Emanuel, who might run for president, helped lead the House Democrats to shellacking Republicans. You look at 2010 and the blowback to the Affordable Care Act during Obama's first midterm, they got shellac there as well in Obama's terms. They lost 63 some seats in Trump's first term in office, which again, similar approval ratings in 2018, Republicans lost 44 seats and control of the House. Now, we don't think it's going to be necessarily that size of a wave right now because of this aggressive cycle of gerrymandering that we're in. But I think anywhere between 15 to 25 seats net gain for Democrats is on the table.
But it isn't just dissatisfaction over the economy. Something else seems to be happening. I think a lot of people are now beginning to believe firmly that the system is not just not working for them, it's rigged against them. And they're angry about this. And we're seeing this happen, and we probably would see it happen more often and in more places were it not for gerrymandering, because people's voices cannot be heard in a gerrymandered state. But a lot of Democratic socialists are winning these primary victories and even unseating incumbents, Democratic incumbents during these primaries. As a result, we've heard Donald Trump, Chris, toss around the word communist, which used to send shivers down the spines of people. I don't think it does anymore, because I think it's lost its, we don't know what communists mean, and Democratic socialists are not communists, but they're offering a different point of view. So if the word communism doesn't have the same heft it used to have, can that attack by Donald Trump and Republicans work against these Democratic socialist candidates? Do people see that they have something to offer in the light of the fact that the system isn't working for them?
I mean, I think the problem for Democrats here and what the Republicans are trying to capitalize on is that we are in a big nationalized political environment, right? So even in the show, right, we're having big conversations about what's going on in South Carolina and what's going on in Maine. We're not talking as much about what's going on in Charlotte. This is very normal. This is how we think about politics. So if you are, let's say, Jamie Ager, who is the Democrat running in the 11th congressional district that Kirk mentioned before. He's a moderate Democrat. He's trying to signal that he's a moderate Democrat. Every time the Republican Party tries to sort of link him to these Democratic socialists, the worse off it is for him. Why? Because Democratic socialism isn't popular, sort of, but really that it's not popular in the 11th congressional district. It's hard to pull these swing districts whenever the Democrats are being sort of get this pejorative term of communist or socialist that is thrown at them. So in a nationalized environment, the Republican move is going to be tie the Democrats to the far left, and the move for the Democrats to be trying to say no, like Jamie Ager is, I'm not a national Democrat. I am a, quote, mountain Democrat, end quote, which is exactly what he's trying to do to signify that he's not part of that Democratic socialist left.
Kirk, it seems to me that if Democrats are successful in taking control of the House, and if they are also successful in taking control of the Senate, they have a lot on their shoulders. I'm not sure I would want to win, because they have a lot of problems to solve. They have the economic problems that we've been talking about that they need to solve. And then they have the Donald Trump problem that they need to solve as he dismantles the federal government and takes an approach that has never been taken, that some people refer to as autocratic, and others call, what's the word I'm looking for? Shoot. It's gone out of my head. Scandalous. Let's just put that word on top of it. So which problem, if you win, do you tackle first? And can you do both? And will you tick
off?
Go ahead.
It's going to be incredibly difficult for any sort of Democratic-controlled Congress to get anything done outside of oversight. I think what you're going to see here pretty quickly is a lot of Trump administration officials hauled up to Capitol Hill to testify. And I think the biggest change is going to be the position of this Republican-controlled Congress has been incredibly supine toward the whims of the president here. You're going to have a very combative Congress, even if Democrats just flip the House. And I think one of the first things that they're going to try to pass is legislation to start rolling back some of these tariffs. That's the most immediate thing they can do, because Congress still has those powers to help reel in the executive branch's power to levy these tariffs. That's going to be the most probably immediate way that they can start reeling it in. But I think, again, even if Democrats just flip one chamber, Trump's entire legislative agenda goes out the window. But again, it's not like he's necessarily been relying on Congress to enact his agenda. He's passed more executive orders during his second term in office than most presidents do in an entire 4-8-year term.
Right.
He's really going around the legislative branch and flexing a lot of power of the executives and testing a lot of constitutional limits right now.
But I have about 30 seconds, 45 seconds left. Restoring accountability and checks and balances is certainly important, because that's how it was designed to work. And it's gone away in the last several years. But what do voters want? I mean, do they want relief at the cash register, or do they want democracy to be restored to the way it used to be?
I think voters right now are fed up and fired up right now. I think they think the system's stacked against them. So anything Democrats can do to level the playing field, I think that's going to be incredibly popular with voters and resonate. But as we've seen in the last six election cycles, it's been a change election. Either the House, Senate, or White House has changed hands, and that's probably going to continue for the next two cycles.
And Chris, very quickly, can Democrats do both?
I guess we'll have to see. How's that for a cop-out?
Okay, that's a cop-out, but it's a good one. Dr. Chris Cooper, professor of political science and director of the Public Policy Institute at Western Carolina University. Daniel Battaglia, congressional impact reporter for the Charlotte Observer and the Raleigh News and Observer, and Kirk Beto, who is the editor of the National Journal Hotline. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. Our intern is Emmy Berger. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to visit past episodes, or to sign up for the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.